happened as indigenous leaders are seeking a public apology from Pope Francis over the Catholic Church's abuse of native children in boarding schools. The United Arab Emirates says that Russian oil is required by energy markets and no producer is able to substitute its production. The U.S. and the Philippines hold a massive joint military exercise amid rising tensions with China over the disputed South China Sea. Live from our Tehran headquarters, this is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Canada's indigenous people are to meet with Pope Francis in the Vatican to ask for an apology for the church's role in residential schools where indigenous children were abused. More than 30 indigenous elders and school survivors are meeting with the Pope on Monday and Friday. Canadian bishops say that they expect the Pope to address both the ongoing trauma and legacy of suffering faced by indigenous peoples to this day. Last year, the remains of 215 children were discovered at the former Indian residential school in the western Canadian province of British Columbia. Hundreds more unmarked burial sites have been found ever since. The harrowing discovery brought new demands for accountability. The schools run mostly by the Catholic Church aim to assimilate Indigenous children between 1831 and 1996. Now moving on, the UAE has poured more cold water on Western efforts to replace Russian energy. It says energy markets need Russian oil and no producer can substitute the production. The UAE energy minister says that OPEC Plus needs to stay together, stay focused, and not allow politics to distract the group. OPEC Plus consists of 23 countries, including Russia. Western nations, including the United States, have been trying to end or slash Europe's reliance on Russian energy resources in response to Moscow's military offensive against Ukraine. Russia is Europe's top oil and gas supplier. Just days ago, the Qatari energy minister also said that his country is currently not able to help Europe with gas deliveries as there is no immediate alternative to Russia. Now, the latest on the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the two have agreed to open two humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians from frontline areas. According to a senior Ukrainian official, under the agreement, people will be allowed to leave the southern city of Mariupol in their cars. More than 3.8 million people have fled Ukraine since over months ago. According to UN, around 90% of them are women and children, and most of them have fled to neighboring Poland. The UN Human Rights Office says over 1,100 civilians have been killed and 1,800 wounded. The World Body says the true casualty figures are expected to be much higher. Ukraine has expressed readiness to discuss neutrality and non-nuclear status in case it is backed by security guarantees from the Kremlin. Ukrainian President says that a deal with Russia is only possible if troops are withdrawn from his country. Volodymyr Zelensky also noted that he would like an all-for-all prisoner exchange and has handed over a list. He added that Kiev wants compromise with Moscow over eastern Donbass region. Zelensky says that he understands that forcing Russia completely out of his country is impossible and would lead to a third world war. Now, we've spoken to political commentator Scott Bennett about the Ukrainian president's willingness to discuss neutrality and non-nuclear status of his country.
I think if he has any semblance of rationality or intelligence, he has come to that conclusion, although he is a very mentally unbalanced and irrational person that is really going off the deep end in many, many respects. He's desperately trying to shame the United States and the United Kingdom into supplying weapons that and troops and anti-air defense materials that just are not going to arrive because the West and NATO does not want to engage in a suicidal war against Russia. The West knows very well that Russia's missile technology and their will to survive will far outweigh any petty commercial makeup wars that the West and NATO tries to engineer. And I think this is going to have a tremendous blowback as well as Russia begins to clean up the operation and it begins to counteract its kinetic operations with civil affairs and public relations campaigns to win the hearts and minds of the people, you're already witnessing countries like Serbia declaring their neutrality towards Russia and NATO. And that's going to be a prevailing trend, as we've discussed from the very beginning of this campaign. The emergence of neutrality as a foreign policy is going to dominate the Eastern European and post-Soviet Republic satellite countries.
Ukrainian intelligence chief says that Russia is trying to split the country into two sections, as happened with North and South Koreas. Bodanov says that Moscow is trying to create a Moscow-controlled region in Ukraine after failing to take over the whole country. He added that Ukrainian forces will soon launch guerrilla warfare against Russia. This, as a European research institute says, that nearly half of Ukrainians aged 18 to 55 are prepared to fight Russia. According to a survey, around 47% of respondents say that they would be willing to join direct military combat fortified defense positions of the Ukrainian forces. Okay, that's for Ukraine for now. The U.S. and the Philippines have started their largest ever joint military drills amid tensions with China over the South China Sea. The exercise involves 9,000 American and Filipino troops that'll last for 2 weeks. The maneuvers by the two focus on potential conflict in the South China Sea. The strategic waters have been a scene of frequent encounters between Chinese and Filipino patrol vessels in recent months. Beijing claims the sea in its almost entirety, but Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Vietnam are among regional countries that have competing claims over the South China Sea. The North Korean leader says his country will continue to reinforce the defense capabilities, promising to build up formidable striking capability and overwhelming military force. Kim Jong-un says only unstoppable military power can prevent a war, ensure the security of the country, and deter threats and blackmails by imperialists. He made those comments in a meeting with scientists and technocrats involved in Thursday's launch of North's largest intercontinental ballistic missile. In response, Washington imposed fresh sanctions. It also imposed sanctions on Russian individuals and entities, accusing them of providing sensitive materials for a North Korean missile program. Pyongyang has tested nearly a dozen weapons this year. Israel correspondent Frank Smith explains why North Korea has recently intensified its missile tests.
And we've seen also a diversification of North Korea's missile arsenal, with hypersonic missiles and cruise missiles being added to their sort of catalog of missile capabilities. Now, the reason that we're seeing this, you know, uptick in North Korea's missile development is that over the past few years, following the failed summitry between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump, Kim Jong-un really hasn't received anything. He has kept his word to have a moratorium on long-range missile tests and nuclear tests, with the understanding that the U.S. would respond with a relief of United Nations Security Council sanctions and overtures toward meaningful negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea that really haven't materialized. Also, it's a message to South Korea, which has a new president that's set to be inaugurated in May.
Now over to Yemen, the government there announcing a new prisoner swap deal with the Saudi-led coalition, including high-profile figures from the former government. The head of the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs says that the deal was agreed early this month with the support of the UN. Abdul Qadir al-Murtada says that the swap deal includes 1,400 Ansarullah members in return for 823 prisoners that include the brother of the former Yemeni president and former defense minister. The official said that the deal awaits an exchange of lists of prisoners on Tuesday. Meantime, a senior UN official in Yemen says that no final deal has been reached by the two sides on the prisoner exchange lists, and discussions are going on. On Saturday, Yemen announced a unilateral ceasefire, declaring readiness for a full prisoner swap. Fazal Najam is the manager of the Canadian Defenders of Human Rights, and he says that the UN is just talking the talk, but not walking the walk when it comes to resolving the dire humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
And we know that since 2 years the war, after the war started, the United Nations said it's the worst humanitarian crisis in the whole world. And now we're going into a seventh year anniversary, now we're walking into the eighth year, unfortunately. And the United Nations has done nothing for the Yemeni people. The United Nations has not passed any resolutions to actually have a real, punishment to the Saudi regime and their coalition that has committed countless amounts of war crimes inside Yemen. They have violated the sovereignty of Yemen. They have blockaded Yemen from all areas. And we see that the world now is focusing and highlighting Ukraine, and the conflict's only about 30 days old. We're talking about 365 days times seven. So you can, anybody that has a calculator can calculate that and see how bad the situation is in Yemen. Children are dying, mothers and fathers are dying, senior citizens are dying, medical supplies are very difficult to get inside Yemen, food supplies, the most basic necessities are hard to get inside Yemen, and the world is silent. The majority of the world is silent.
Israeli crop duster planes have sprayed toxic herbicides over Gaza farmlands as Tel Aviv continues inhumane acts of aggression against the impoverished region. Farmers in Gaza see no end in sight to their suffering. Ashraf Shannon has the details.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to bush the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations. Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and wars since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Presidential election in France has been unlike any other in recent memory, with apathy and disinterest dominating headlines. This is the first major vote in the West since the end of the coronavirus, and that may explain why France appears unusually politically disoriented. From Paris, Rami Mazahari reports.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left, may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression.
We are here to protest against the abusive government and this kingship presidency of Emmanuel Macron. The Yellow Vests are here to promote a true vision of democracy and to redistribute our nation's wealth. Every election there is more and more abstention because people don't believe in mainstream politics anymore.
In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the Yellow Vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election. France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
The fourth criterion is diligence in the face of the enemy. We should know the enemy, and we should be sensitive in the face of the enemy's moves. Those who were on the front lines during the sacred defense era know that there were some individuals within our bases who followed with the help of their agents every small move made by the enemy. Then they would focus on it. Imagine that the enemy has made a particular move. They would ask, what is his goal and why did he do it? They used to find a reason. They were diligent towards the enemy's moves. We should know the enemy and identify his plans. We should be diligent about his plots, his words, and his statements. and we should find an antidote for the poison that he will probably use, and we should be ready to foil his move. This is sensitivity in the face of the enemy. Well, what is the opposite of this sensitivity? One is that some people deny the existence of the enemy. When we speak about an enemy, such individuals say, you are suffering from an illusion or an illusion of conspiracy. In my opinion, bringing up this illusion of conspiracy is a conspiracy in itself.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In order to decrease sensitivities, they say, who is the enemy? Or which enmity? They deny the most obvious things. What we are saying is that America is the enemy of the revolution. It is the nature of global imperialism to show enmity towards a system such as the Islamic Republic. Their interests are 180 degrees different from each other. Global imperialism is about treachery, waging wars, creating and organizing terrorist groups, suppressing freedom-seeking groups, and exerting pressure over the oppressed, such as the oppressed people of Palestine and countries like Palestine. This is the nature of global imperialism. Take note, it is 100 years now that America and England have been pressuring the people of Palestine. They have been doing so before the formation of the Zionist regime in the year 1948 and after that, till this day. Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
The ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched in the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. But the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, to Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories, and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand. In recent days, Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted again Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up. But it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stirred up controversy after suggesting that his country could lead the world. Speaking at a business roundtable meeting, Joe Biden referred twice to, quote, a new world order. The phrase quickly became a trending topic on social media on Monday. On the surface, a new world order means a dramatic paradigm shift in international affairs and a change in the balance of power at the global scale. But what the U.S. president didn't consider when uttering those words was the connotation they carry with them. New World Order has for years been used by conspiracy theorists to mean a situation in which a secret cabal of governments take matters into their own hands to form a multinational totalitarian and oppressive regime. Which definition Biden might have been going for is beside the point. The main issue is that he took it upon himself to lead the world. The statement is a fundamental rejection of the world's multipolarity.
We have to always bear in mind that those who are in power, the hegemonic powers of the world, in particular the United States and their European allies, as well as the Zionist entity, they're always planning and always plotting, if you want to use that word, on how to further increase, how to maintain, how to strengthen, how to bolster the power that they already have.
How can the U.S. and its Western allies sideline their rivals, including Russia and China, that are superpowers? The West has been announcing new sanctions against Russia since it began its special military operation into Ukraine. Russia's financial and energy sectors have been under the West's crosshairs.
We are determined to continue to impose costs on Russia to bring about the end of this brutal war.
But Russia was already under sanctions before the conflict even started. This has had many speculating that the West might have been looking for an excuse to increase pressure on Moscow.
These people, these people in power, and I'm talking specifically the United States here, they are trying to get rid of these hurdles which they consider to be very bothersome impediments to their power projection. So the United States at this moment is trying to completely get rid of the national sovereign powers that still exist in the world, for example, Russia, China, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, you know, all sorts of countries that are refusing to bow down and to accept the globalist world order. These countries are now in particular being targeted.
But such pressure would backfire at those imposing them too. The most basic example is the EU's reliance on Russian energy. At a time when the bloc faces an energy crisis and soaring consumer prices, sanctioning a major producer of gas, oil, and wheat doesn't seem like a sound plan. Russia isn't sitting idly by. Moscow has been planning initiatives to cushion the blow of sanctions on its economy. President Vladimir Putin announced this week that his country has drawn up a list of, quote, unfriendly countries that need to pay for their energy purchases from Russia in rubles. U.S. President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office, promising to bring back diplomacy and to reverse his predecessor's misguided policies. 14 months into his presidency, however, he is following in the footsteps of the Donald Trump administration. How much longer will it take for the U.S. to realize that the unipolar world is no more?
U.S. President Joe Biden has claimed that his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall and that the Russian leader did not anticipate the strength of NATO's unity in supporting Ukraine. This is despite Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky lashing out on a regular basis against the North Atlantic Alliance's lack of support for his country in the face of Russia's military operation. Nevertheless, Biden claims Russia's accusations that Kiev has biological and chemical weapons means Putin is considering using them himself in the Ukraine conflict. The White House has not provided any evidence to support Biden's claims.
Turn the tables around and begin to accuse the accuser, so to speak. This is a classic case, classic situation. So now they, rather than sort of trying to justify themselves, what these labs were doing there, why were they sponsored, what kind of research they were doing, they turn the tables around and say that Russians want to use it as a pretext for some attack.
A senior American defense official speaking to reporters on condition of anonymity has acknowledged that Washington has no concrete information of a Russian chemical or biological weapons attack. It just happens that Biden's accusation comes after Russian forces stumbled on what Moscow says are U.S.-funded biological research facilities near the Russian border, and asked the White House to explain why it financed a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens. It's not the first time America has leveled accusations concerning the use of chemical weapons as a pretext to militarily intervene in other countries. Perhaps the biggest example is the case of Iraq, where American officials presented alleged intelligence that Baghdad was in possession of weapons of mass destruction, which led to the disastrous US-led invasion of Iraq that killed more than 1 million Iraqis. In Syria, Washington and its Western allies claimed the Syrian government used chemical weapons, and America attacked the Arab country despite evidence later emerging that terrorists who the Syrian government had been fighting were the ones who staged the false flag operations. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons even announced the Syrian government's chemical stockpile had been destroyed. There are now concerns Washington will use similar false flag operations in Ukraine.
Really inhumane thing to do. A, you know, it's immoral in terms of kind of lying and trying to blame the other side for your own faults, for your own, you know, sins. But another one, it will just simply escalate the whole thing, because to make this kind of fake attack will probably poison and destroy people, and it will just strengthen Russian resolve and Russian anger. So
Biden says that Putin knows there'll be severe consequences because of what he described as a united NATO front, but did not specify what actions the alliance would take. Some cracks have appeared in the NATO alliance, in particular among European countries.
NATO already did all it could. I don't think it will come down, to some kind of exchange of nuclear arms. But I think it's basically we continue in this war of, in the court of public opinion. So the idea and the purpose of the NATO is very simple: to justify their existence, that they're good, they're a force of goodness, as opposed to their opponents, be it Syria, be it Iran, be it Russia. Their opponents are so bad that they are willing to utilize every nasty thing in the book, and that's what we want to do. So it'll be a victory primarily psychological.
In such cases, the issue of timing tends to come up. Biden's remarks come amid peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. The talks haven't been as smooth as many would wish. Nevertheless, there are negotiations which, for some odd reason, the Biden White House is not supporting. And that leads to the question as to why America and some of its Western allies are not backing the ongoing efforts to end this conflict peacefully.
With the conflict between Russia and Ukraine ongoing for over 3 weeks, Turkey is playing a significant role to de-escalate the tensions. The country is hosting high-level discussions between the two sides aimed at reaching a ceasefire, expressing readiness to host talks between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia. In the meantime, reports suggest that the United States has informally suggested that Turkey send its Russian-made S-400 missile defense systems to Ukraine to help Kiev with its fight against Russian forces. The report suggests that American officials have floated the idea with their Turkish counterparts, but no formal request was made. The idea was also mentioned during Deputy State Secretary Wendy Sherman's visit to Turkey earlier this month. That seems too convenient for the U.S. and its Western allies that have been asking Turkey to abandon its Russian-made air defenses and instead use American-made Patriot counterparts.
Yes, it's exactly the same system that they complained about earlier. But the political geometry has changed a little bit, so the United States is trying to turn things around to bring Turkey closer and to separate it a little more from Russia. and to overcome the debacle for the U.S. that the Turkey's purchase of these missiles created earlier.
Observers say Turkey will almost certainly reject the proposal, but the fact that it's even being offered reveals the West's opportunistic policies. Turkey signed a multi-billion dollar agreement to acquire several batteries of Russia's S-400 missile defense system in 2017. The West wasn't pleased with the deal, arguing that installing such systems in a NATO country would potentially compromise the security of the military alliance, as well as pose a risk to the newly developed F-35 fighter jets. The first batch of the Russian-made system was delivered to Turkey in 2019, enraging the West. Former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions on Turkey over the incident and cut Ankara, a financial and manufacturing partner, from the F-35 program. Turkey has demanded repayment of some $1.4 billion it put into the program, but so far hasn't received anything back. Turkey stresses that it opted for the Russian system as the Western-made counterparts were not offered to it at agreeable terms. The U.S. suggestion that Ankara send its S-400 missile defense system to Ukraine to shoot down Russian fighter jets, apart from the technical hurdles of delivering and installing them, would potentially risk a Russian blowback. Washington has certainly predicted that any deterioration of ties between Ankara and Moscow could harm Turkey's position as a neutral broker and derail the ceasefire talks. That raises some serious questions about the U.S. stated willingness to end the conflict in Ukraine as soon as possible.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars, IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atar, the host of this program. Within the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Ali Himani and Shaykh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. So today we want to talk about a very controversial topic, and that is owning a gun. Is it at all right to have a gun, or should all people have the right to own guns? Of course, in some countries, amendments in their constitution, they are allowed to carry a gun, whether it would be an open carry or a concealed carry, but they are allowed, you know, somehow to have gun. But is it at all, according to the Islamic rulings, to have a gun or something like a gun with yourself? You can find it also in the games that the children are playing, you know, such graphic scenes and the violence that is over there, the shooting. And you know that the school shooting in the U.S., you know, mean an attack on this institutional education or something like that, such as primary school or university, is a big case now in the U.S. And year after year, you know, administration after administration, they are adding amendments to the U.S. Constitution in order to control it, but they are not still successful. At least every year, we have one school shooting in the U.S. with the massacre of the killing of so many innocent people, you know, but one guy. Correct. And the last step, but by taking suicide, you know.
Yeah.
In most of the cases, the killer
after
commits
killing,
suicide.
He kills himself.
He kills himself. And when you do research about their lives, they are all under the shadow and under the influence of these media coverage.
Correct.
That he's using of the guns, okay?
Correct.
Yeah, so, you know, exactly.
No, the brother was talking about the culture that may prevent people from from abusing guns, mm-hmm. and actually that works perfectly in many cases actually, but not at all times. We should have this self piety, within ourselves.
Self-control.
Self-control. And this piety, I like to yes. call it sort of piety. Okay. And that's just, very hard to mm-hmm. have, And so it's so hard, I believe, that even though that, you have the best culture, you're living in a very good country, yes. There is no problem, no poverty or anything.
Yes.
But this self-control or this self-piety that you may have, if you don't have that, in a case, in a fight that you may have with somebody or in, mm-hmm. You take lose your control and, you just take out the gun and start shooting. So,
yes.
And this doesn't, relate to having restricted laws or not, yes. Or things like that, or having yes. the best culture in the yes. world or not. So this is within human beings. So if you don't have that, yes. that taqwa, if you don't yes. have that self-control, yes. I believe that may, burst out sometime. Correct.
Absolutely true.
Recently, Ayatollah Khamenei called America and American administration a mafia.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. when you look at the lives of the mafias, they're carrying guns. Gun is an inseparable part of the mafia lifestyle in administration, in industry, in Correct. Politics, and everything.
Yeah.
So when you're acting as the mafia, then the people think that they're in a mafia game. They have to carry guns. They have to predict, kill exactly. this, kill that, okay, in order to have more. Another case is this type of, fake type of the fear from the side of especially the colored people in the U.S. From one side, they invite the others in order to migrate to the countries. From the other side, they consider them as the minorities. And then, for example, we know that the delinquency, is very much among the colored people, especially okay. in the suburban part of the okay. U.S., U.S. states, so especially the black ones, when you go there, they carry guns, they kill the people. So the police, in order to protect himself, only have one warning, and after one warning, shoots.
That's okay. And that's all. But our okay. concern is not about police carrying the yes. guns. Our concern yeah. is about the civilians
the
carrying
civilians,
the guns.
The civilians, that's
gun,
right. right? So, I do want to say this is the problem, because correct. Because correct. The police know that one warning, if there is no answer, he will shoot. So he will shoot sooner, exactly. okay? This is the case.
Again, the fact, case. Brother Atta, here is that, after one warning, why does the police feel that the other guy is going to shoot,
okay,
right? This is the fundamental question.
Yes.
Again, it brings back to the cultural aspect that yes. they have little value for human life.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there are cultures, like look at China, look at Japan, look at India, until about 20 years ago. Look at other regions, like you can see Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, these regions, the culture gives extreme importance to the human life.
Mm-hmm.
Middle Eastern countries, Dubai, African countries, which are yes. Egypt and others, where the Islam gives utmost importance to human life. Even if the person is carrying a gun, because of a conflict, he doesn't pull out a gun and shoot the person.
Yes.
Why? Because he gives value to the human life that he's facing, he's standing opposite to.
That's
but
right.
in America, they do not give enough value to the human life. Mm-hmm. They don't value it. They see it lesser than a dog.
Mm-hmm.
The dog is more important. Yes. There was a movie called John Wick.
Yes.
Right? In John Wick, a couple of guys walk into his house. They try to steal his car. They steal the car and they kill the dog. Now, because they killed his dog, he goes around killing 500 people, right? So 500 people are worth less than this dog's life, right? So the culture there
yes.
is promoting this idea that human life is not that important. What is important is you. As
That's
long
fine.
As you're there, your safety is there, you are secured, it's okay. And that's why you will see that when America invades Afghanistan, when America invades Iraq, they don't care. They just shoot and kill. You
yes.
would see videos from Black Waters. They're killing people who have
yes.
no weapon. These are civilians.
Civilians.
And then they
fine.
Laugh and they say they're like sitting ducks and they're shooting
yes.
these people, right?
That's
so
fine.
That shows that the culture being promoted there is that human life does not have value. The only thing that matters is you mm. and things around you.
That's right. Especially, the Europe and the U.S., has passed two world wars, okay? And these world wars, I think, has made a kind of fear rooted in the very character of the nations that in order to protect yourself, you have to have gun or weapons, whether it's cold, whether it's hot, and use it whenever you like it. But the case is that, the age of the use of the guns, especially among the children, you know, now they are talking about the children using guns among themselves in the schools. And this is really, you know, how is it possible for example, a student to kill the teacher? You know, this is really a rare case, never taking place during the history, but in the news in the 40s, 50s.
Not just that part, brother. Okay. Atta, there's another important element about children using the gun. There's accidental firing where the father keeps the gun at home and does not follow necessary precautions or locks the gun or use the right kind of locks. And there are so many accidental killings. Son killed a 5-year-old kid, you know, trying to see what the gun is, accidentally fires and kills his own father, right? So the risk is not about just pulling a gun out during a conflict and kill someone.
That's right.
But there are so many more problems to it. Mm-hmm. Having it at home, letting a 5-year-old kid have access to it itself gives, you know, a thorough risk to the whole family.
Sheikh Qasim, you gave us some guidelines, self-control, piety, you know, control anger management, something like that. Okay, they can really help us in order to forget using the gun. What other guidelines, for example, Islam gives us as a religion to have more protection or to have more control over ourselves?
As I said, I believe that the best way and not to have such tragedies is not to have guns. You know, because as I said, it's so hard to control oneself. Especially, as I said, it goes back to the self-taqwa and self-piety that a person may have or have not. So the best way is that the governments, the state, do not allow people to have guns and for special forces like the police to have guns. And even for the police, as you know, in Iran, it's so hard for the police to use his gun, you know. And we recently had, you know, a tragedy, an accident.
Mr. Ranjbar, you know, one of the second lieutenant of Shiraz, you know, passed away
using the gun. Because he didn't use it. He actually did have a gun, but he didn't use it because it's so hard in the law, in the Islamic law, actually Iranian Islamic law, to use the gun. As you rightly mentioned, you know, because Iranians and the Islamic laws of Iran value a lot the life of people. You know, a person should not use his or her weapon.
Loosely and leniently, you know, whenever you have a chance, just pull out and shoot.
And with respect to the students using guns, I believe again we have to go back to the way of life. They're actually way of life and lifestyle. So this person, I don't know, a 10-year-old boy. So he's at home and he's actually playing a video game. Yes. I don't know those video games. And he goes to the school and want to practically, you know, apply those things that he has been taught, you know, in those video games. So
all that adrenaline that has built up in him after playing Call of Duty real, and Band of Brothers, he wants to show something.
That's right. I hope that guns are not produced at all in the world and not, you know, because if we are consider ourselves as the creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which are, you know, we are on different tribes with different languages, with different cultures, but we have to know each other more through the language, through, you know, rationality, through knowing each other's culture more. But nowadays, unfortunately, this sense of greed among the people of going to the other lands, you know, and, you know, attacking here, attacking there, you know, killing this one, killing that one, and having nuclear weapons more than the other countries, having nuclear arsenals, you know, has made the world really a dangerous place to live. That's all right. I hope that one day all these problems are solved. Again, it gets back very much to your lifestyle.
I I do hope, truly, really, but yes, that's not really going to happen. You know, there are a couple of reasons for that. One, if you just go back about 100 years in the history, you would see that wars was very common. Britishers and the French and the Portuguese, they used to go around, colonize places, and they used to carry guns with them. So the gun industry was really booming at that time, right? But after World War II, everybody realized that war is bad. So there's going to be no more wars, right? Even today, people talk about that conflict, it might lead to Third World War, right? But no one wants a war.
Okay.
So now the gun industry is in a fix. How do I sell guns? If there's going to be no wars, now how do I make profit? How do I make money? So the best way to do and make money is to hand over guns in the hands of citizens. They are the ones providing guns to all the mafias and cartels and diamond cartels and drug lords and all that. They are making money out of it. Okay. On the other hand, on the TV, they say, like, we are against drugs, we are against this and that. Mm-hmm. But they finally need to make profit, and they are the ones promoting this whole idea. So until and unless they you know, control their greed and overcome their desire to be the most powerful and the richest people, this gun industry is
very much
survive.
Very much rooted in the secular secular perspective, and the secular look at the life. You know, if we want to change it into a monotheistic one or religious one, you know, gun will be eliminated from the lives of the people. Inshallah, one day. I hope so.
Inshallah.
Okay. Thank you much, Sheikh Qasem and Sheikh Ali Himani, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, it was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, the people, and also the region as a whole. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Nowruz and how it is celebrated in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Nowruz in India and International Nowruz Day.
The spelling of Nowruz and its pronunciation may vary country to country, but across all nations, it means the new day. It marks the first day of spring and is celebrated as the beginning of the new year by over 300 million people in different parts of the world. Nowruz has been celebrated for over 3,000 years in the Balkans, the Black Sea Basin, the Caucasus, the West, Central and South Asian region, and of course, the subcontinent.
Nowruz, March the 21st of the Gregorian calendar, is the Iranian New Year, also known as the Persian New Year. It begins on the spring equinox on the northern hemisphere. It marks the first day of Farvardin, which is the first month of the Iranian solar calendar. In Iran, one of the most important traditions practiced during this time is that families and loved ones gather around a table called Haftsin. It is decorated with at least seven objects whose names start with an S in the Persian language. The items symbolize purity, brightness, livelihood, and wealth. People wish for prosperity and new beginnings at the New Year time.
What really Nowruz is? It is really